From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, another invasive species could do serious damage to Wisconsin's forests. Then, when you go looking for nature, don't underestimate the humble moth.
I mean, I think we just kind of lump moths as the little brown things that are often kind of a nuisance. There are some just stunningly beautiful moths out there. And yeah, if you kind of look for them and seek them out, you'll be blown away by the diversity.
What theatergoers get out of performances at the zoo.
As a theater director, I'm always thinking about how is the audience perceiving this? And when the audiences walk away, I want them to feel empowered. I want them to know that they can make a difference.
And if you've ever wanted to ride an old-fashioned bicycle, this weekend might be your chance. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. When we hear about invasive worms, our first instinct in 2014 is to think of a computer virus like the recent Heartbleed attack. But the news that Wisconsin is dealing with an invasion by the so-called crazy worm actually refers to an invasive earthworm. The worm, officially known as the Amynthis agrestis, has been definitely identified at the UW Arboretum in Madison, where researchers first spotted it late last year. And it has the potential to be as dangerous to Wisconsin's forests as the emerald ash borer and other invasive pests. Brad Herrick is arboretum ecologist and research program manager at the Arboretum, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
How did you and your colleagues discover this worm at the UW Arboretum?
By chance, actually. We discovered it last fall in October, ironically during an invasive species workshop that we were holding here in conjunction with folks from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and the Indiana Nature Conservancy. And one of the speakers, Bernie Williams, who's with the DNR and is the state worm expert, was going to go show the participants how to sample for worms. And so we went to this area where I knew we could find lots of worms, and she had just talked about this new worm that was sort of on the horizon as a new invasive species that we were worried about, called Amynthis agrestis, and that, you know, it wasn't in the state yet. Well, we go out to this woods, and we kind of rake away some of the leaves on the forest floor, and lo and behold, there is this worm that is literally jumping off the ground. And, you know, Bernie took a step back and was like, oh my gosh, this is the species that we didn't think was here. So that's how we discovered it at the Arboretum, purely by chance.
And it was fairly obvious fairly quickly that this was this species that you had been worried about.
Yes, especially in late summer, early fall is when they're pretty large in size and the most dense in terms of their population. And so, yeah, they were, all you had to do was literally rake away the top layer of leaves, and they're right on the surface of the soil. And if, you know, once you agitate them by clearing the leaves and moving them around, they are really, really jumpy and slithering around. So it was very apparent to Bernie, at least right away, that this is something different, and this is the worm that they were concerned about.
And this jumpy behavior is how they get their nickname, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they have several common names: crazy worm, jumping worm, snake worm, Alabama jumper, and because of this characteristic.
Well, we've been talking around this for a little bit, but tell us more about the significance of this worm and why it is seen as such a threat.
Well, right. So the biggest concern with this worm, and actually the other worm that is similar to this worm, it's a European variety commonly known as the nightcrawler, used for fishing bait, is that these earthworms, they consume the forest floor. So they would literally eat leaves off of the forest floor, and they have voracious appetites, and so they can move. They can spread very quickly, especially it's a high concern in the northern hardwood forests, where they will eat the leaf layer. And this leaf layer is sort of a protective spongy layer that in the native plants need to germinate and to spread. And when that's gone, it makes it very difficult for native plants to exist. We see a lot more soil erosion in the understory, and it sort of sets the stage for other invasive species, plants and animals, to move in. So it really fundamentally can change the forest ecosystem. And so whether it's the European earthworm or this new earthworm, we're concerned about both of them. But this one, we're concerned about even more, maybe, because it can reproduce much more quickly.
I gather it does not need another earthworm around to reproduce.
Exactly. Yeah, the term is parthenogenic. So they reproduce asexually. They can drop cocoons, which form the eggs all by themselves once they're sexually mature. And so that alone is a difference. And so they can really create high numbers quickly and move into the landscape faster.
Is there a connection to, and the forests are already under stress from things like the emerald ash borer? Does this make, say, ash trees more susceptible to, or less healthy and more susceptible to other invasives like the ash borer?
I can't speak to the ash borer specifically, but in general, I would say yes. That it just makes the forest ecosystem, whether it's the trees or the herbaceous plants, more susceptible to, other disturbances like invasive species, because it's basically compromising the health of the forest in a significant way that can allow other invasive plants to move in and further damage the forest in other ways.
I gather this is a worm that has been found for some time in the Southeast and Mid-Atlantic. What has been the impact of the worm in those ecosystems?
So, I'm not as familiar with impact in those areas, but it's, as I understand, it's been a similar impact. So, very devastating to the understory of those forests. And, for a long time, it was thought that it was sort of a southern climate species, that it wouldn't be able to persist over winter in the northern climates like Wisconsin. But that seems to be not the case. It seems to be adapting to colder climates. It overwinters in a cocoon stage and then will hatch in the spring. And so, that's another concern, is that it is adapting to cooler climates, we think.
Is it true that all of the earthworms in general in Wisconsin are invasive to some degree, that all the truly native earthworms here were wiped out by the glaciers?
That is true. All the worms that we have in Wisconsin are at least non-native. Not all are considered invasive, but they all are non-native. So and that gets back to sort of the impact on the forest, is that since the last glaciation, these hardwood forest systems developed without the presence of earthworms. And so when you introduce sort of a foreign species, especially an invasive species, it can really, change the composition of the forest in a negative way.
What sorts of precautions have you already taken now that the worm has been definitively identified here? And what's your hope for what management that we can do?
Mm-hmm. So what we've done, so we're still sort of at the infancy here of learning about this species and how it behaves in Wisconsin. And so what we're trying to do right now is get a better handle on where the worm is in the arboretum spatially. So we're starting to conduct surveys to find out where the worm is, where the worm isn't in the arboretum. And so for the time being, until we have a good sense for where the worm is, we're really using what's called best management practices, or BMPs. And some of those are pretty simple measures. So first of all, we try and avoid areas that we know the worm persists. If we can't avoid, then we make sure that we always brush off the bottom of our shoes or our boots after we leave an area that we think is infested, so that we don't inadvertently carry the worm or carry its cocoon to other areas. We'll wash down our tires on our vehicles. So those are the main things that we can do that's pretty low maintenance, easy to do. And that's what we've been telling other folks to do, too, if they suspect they've seen this worm in their yard, in their compost bin, in their, mulch piles, is, try and stay out of those areas, or at least, make sure that your boots are clean, all your tools are cleaned, And, of course, let the DNR know right away if you suspect that you've seen this species.
The Arboretum is a landscape that I would think is pretty closely managed or certainly closely watched. Do you have a sense for how the worm may have taken up residence there?
We don't know for sure. We do think it was an accidental introduction through the nursery trade. So we have we're obviously an arboretum, so we have a woody plant collection in Longenecker Gardens. And so we've gotten plants over the years from all over the country, including the southeast part of the country where this worm has been present for quite a while. And so we think that it's come in on plant material, probably rootstock of woody plants that has been brought to our nursery. And then, you know, once they're in the ground for a few years, those worms can spread out very easily. So it makes sense where we found it was close to our staging nursery in that area. So we think that's how we first got the worm.
And is the idea right now that you're trying to quarantine it essentially in the particular area where you found it?
Yeah, more or less. You know, we're taking sort of reasonable precautions. You know, we have to work in those areas because it's, you know, it's obviously it's a part of our nursery, it's part of it's part of our garden system. But again, like with those BMPs, we are taking measures to ensure that we are not spreading the worm anywhere else into the arboretum. Or for sure outside of the arboretum.
Would you imagine that if it's at the arboretum, it's likely to be someplace else in the state as well?
Yeah, I would say it's probably likely. This is the first confirmed report. There have been other unconfirmed reports in Madison that Bernie Williams and the DNR are checking into. So, you know, even though this is the first confirmed report, I know the DNR is constantly looking for this species and other invasive species, so we never know for sure if there's been an introduction elsewhere, given how small these critters are.
Well, Brad Herrick, thank you so much. Best of luck in your work.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Brad Herrick is arboretum ecologist and research program manager at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum in Madison. The arboretum is the location of the first confirmed sighting of the Amynthis agrestis, the invasive crazy worm in Wisconsin. In case you're wondering, the worm is a prohibited species to own or transport in the state, so its use as bait here is illegal. From a worm we'd rather not see in Wisconsin to the appeal of spotting moths. We'll talk National Moth Week in just a moment. Meanwhile, Big Dipper's extraordinary worm on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. As you might already know, parts of the Milwaukee area are a key corridor in the migration route of the monarch butterfly. The sight of thousands of butterflies in Wisconsin meadow is one that delights many. But what about the sight of thousands of moths? Many people might not think it's such a great thing, but considering that moths are pretty similar to their butterfly cousins, aside from coming out at night versus the daytime, they're really not held in nearly the same esteem. Well, National Moth Week is out to change that, and our Outdoor Adventure contributors, Stacy Tornio and Ken Keffer, have some suggestions for how you can go mothing. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey there.
Let's talk about a verb that I don't know many people think of as a verb, but it's mothing. I don't know that many people think of an action that goes along with these things that can sometimes be irritating if you find them in your closets.
That's right. It's kind of like, think of butterflying, which is an even longer word. But that, I think
I prefer to call it lepidoptery.
But I think people can relate to that a little bit more. So it's like, oh, the monarch butterflies, those big swallowtails that you see, that's so cool. And you see them out during the day and you're so excited. And so this is the nighttime version of that. And Ken is actually the one who introduced mothing to me the first time.
Ken, are moths underrated?
Oh, for sure. You know, I mean, I think we just kind of lump moths as the little brown things that are often kind of a nuisance. There are some just stunningly beautiful moths out there. And yeah, if you kind of look for them and seek them out, and you will be blown away by the diversity. And the best part is there's so many moths that scientists don't even know what they all are. So, you know, you could discover a new species, but you don't even have to worry about identifying them. You're like, oh, that's the pretty one, you know, and they kind of keep your own little list going of things you see.
It is a strange bucket list, though, to that brown one or that kind of brown one with yellow spots or whatever. So how do you go about doing it, aside from the idea of just like standing outside and looking at your porch light?
Yeah, I mean, it's as simple as that for some folks, and that's kind of could be the spark moment for the moth. And you'd be like, whoa, that one's different, and you want to learn more about it. But if you really get excited about it, you know, and kids love this sort of stuff, it's like a scavenger hunt. You know, you're like, what are you going to find? The anticipation is so much a part of mothing. And so all you can do is you can hang a sheet up so that gives them something to land on. It makes it a little easier to actually see them and kind of look at them for a while and observe them. You can use a light, you know, just a light bulb kind of projected on there. A black light will help bring in some different species. Or if you want to go really crazy, you can use moth bait, which is basically the cheapest can of, you know, beverage that you can find. Some maple sugar, some molasses, some brown sugar, you know, something sweet to stir it up in there, and some bananas that are as brown as you can possibly stand to have them. Moths love it. It's like candy.
Do you have to wait till it's completely dark outside, or will dusk do the trick?
Well, nighttime is definitely the time to go mothing. I mean, there is a misconception that moths are only at night, and that's not true. So, you know, if you come across like kind of a fuzzier looking butterfly during the day, it might actually be a moth. But the cool part about mothing is like looking out at night. The kids will love it because they probably get to stay up past their bedtime. And, you know, you can check those moths like every 30 minutes or so, and you never know what you'll find.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to add that, you know, I mean, while you're out there, too, I mean, a lot of times it's something you'll be doing off on the side, too. You know, you're going to have a backyard camp out. You got a little campfire in the corner. You know, put a little moth sheet up. You know, maybe smear some of that bait on the tree or something. Catch some fireflies in between. I mean, just add it to the evening's activities and stuff, and it's going to be so much fun. You're really going to be impressed.
Well, and when we think about going out and looking at butterflies, you know, butterflies, of course, are famous for migrating, sometimes thousands and tens of thousands of miles. That is not the case with moths.
Right. And it's not all butterflies that are migrating too, you know, but some of those big, powerful flyers like the monarch and stuff. But yeah, I mean, moths are going to – in the summertime, they'll be active and flying. And then the winter, they'll kind of overwinter as a larval stage, you know, right here in Wisconsin and stuff. But yeah.
Yeah, and I just think that moths like get this bad rap. I mean, we actually have a mutual friend who hates moths. Like it's almost a phobia. She doesn't want to see a moth. She doesn't want to be near a moth. And I think, you know, it's summertime. It's a good time for reading. Like take the kids to the library and like pick out a moth book. And I guarantee you there's going to be something really cool in there that they're going to be like, whoa, I didn't know that that could be in my backyard.
My favorite moth is – it's called an underwing moth. And on the surface, you know, those kind of upper wings are this brown color. But if you get to look in and sometimes they'll kind of flap that wing, the back wings are brilliant, like orange or pink. They're super bright and stuff. And so, yeah, sometimes they're a little more subtle, but the beauty's always there.
And to get the moths to go away at the end of the activity, just turn off the light?
You turn off the light, you know, and leave the sheet up too. Let them fly away on their own. Don't try and shake them out, you know. But yeah, you go out in the morning and then you can just maybe like just move along the last three or four stragglers. But yeah, they'll move on their own.
Moths not just for eating your sweaters.
Exactly.
Stacy, Ken, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Yep, thanks.
Stacy Tornio and Ken Keffer are the creators of the website DestinationNature.net and the authors of the Kids Outdoor Adventure Book, 448 Great Things to Do in Nature Before You Grow Up. They are also our regular outdoor adventure contributors. National Moth Week begins Saturday. Don't forget to buy your cards. There is a link to the official website, and of course there is an official National Moth Week website from wuwm.com/lake effect. Why theater is an important part of the mission of the Milwaukee County Zoological Society. That story when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. The Milwaukee County Zoo is best known for the animals that call it home, from bonobos to penguins to Wisconsin fauna like the timber wolf. One of the key goals of the zoo and the Zoological Society is to educate the public about animals, their habitats, and issues surrounding their continued well-being. And one of the ways they do that is through theatrical performances. Cole's Wild Theater is a year-round program that puts on performances at the zoo and in community places like schools and civic organizations. The plays highlight the conservation message of the zoo and information about the animals themselves. James Mills is the Director of Conservation Education for the Zoological Society of Milwaukee County's Education Department, and David McClellan is Theater Coordinator. They spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North, and Mills explained how their work fits in with the mission of the Zoological Society.
So we conserve wildlife. We have a conservation division. We are, in my department, one of the three pillars, education, to educate people about animals. And third is to, very importantly, support the Milwaukee County Zoo, this wonderful gem we have in the community.
So the Zoological Society is not part of the zoo. It's just in support of it.
It's a nonprofit support partner of the zoo.
What kinds of things do you try to do in the community to get people aware of animals and endangered species and that sort of thing?
Our department's existed since 1976, and we have a full array of programs, school programs, of which Cole's Wild Theater is a part. And we've got programs that are done for the membership, the very large membership of the Zoological Society, and members of the public. So in addition to Cole's Wild Theater shows, we offer over 30 different school programs at the zoo or as outreach, and serve about 25,000 children through that element of the program. We also offer a wide array of fall, winter, and spring classes for children ages 2 to 14. And we're launching what we call stroller safari programming for infants up to age 2. We offer programs for families, and we offer programs for children and adults. Children who are up to age 5 can attend with a parent. And these are in addition to all the programs that are done at the zoo by our wonderful volunteer corps, doing education, either talks at exhibits or through interpretive carts, we call, remains to be seen, and keeper talks that are done. There's much education done at the zoo beyond our department, but we are a major factor in telling stories of the animals that are exhibited at the zoo and beyond. We're currently in our summer camp season, which is one of the largest summer camp programs in the nation that's zoo-based, and we offer about 33 different topics at this time.
What are some of the most popular ones? What do people want to know about?
Well, in conservation education, one of the things we like to do is focus on the conservation role of the zoo itself, and we often look at the keepers at the zoo as kind of rock stars, so people are very interested in the work that's done, both by the keepers themselves, the veterinary team that works to help healthcare for all the animals. And so career-based things are very popular. So we have junior zookeeper classes, senior zookeeper classes. Then for 12 to 14 years, we get more into careers that are potential for people
who are interested
zoo.
In animals,
yes.
And want to take care of them.
As I said, for programs for 2 through 5 year olds, parents can attend. And so we do adult education. We know the parents just love to learn alongside their children.
So, Dave, with the Cole's Theater, the Wild Theater program, how does that serve the mission of the zoo? Or the Zoological Society, I should say.
Like James said, the mission is conserve, educate, and support. And so really, Cole's Wild Theater focuses on all of those. Each show that we develop starts with an educational message. And that message is designed for children and their families who are visiting the Milwaukee County Zoo in terms of our summer programs. And with our outreach, it's really focused on curriculum needs for teachers. But either way, we're focusing on these educational topics. We always want to highlight both conservation that's happening at the zoo, but we also try to provide our audience with conservation tools that they can do themselves. You know, kids from home can take lots of actions for conservation, and that's highlighted. And then lastly, supporting the Milwaukee County Zoo, our theater program performs 7 days a week at the zoo, 4 performances per day, free of charge.
When you're developing shows, and now I'm talking about the theater component of this, how long are these performed? Are they like 50-minute shows or something like that,
an
hour?
Cole's Wild Theater is a multifaceted program. And so I like to think of it in two separate ways. There's our zoo programming, and then there's our outreach programming. When you're at the zoo, our performances are either 15 minutes long at our main stage, or you can also find actors at specific exhibits through the day where they perform for maybe only 2 minutes at a time. But then after that two-minute mini performance, they're interacting with children. They're interacting with families with puppets or magic tricks, different ways to continue the conversation about conservation and education about whatever animal they're looking at. So They're usually a shorter form when you're at the zoo to match that whole zoo visit experience. Now, when we go into the community and we become the featured event for, say, an assembly program at a school, well, then we usually perform for about 30 to 45 minutes. And then, of course, we also go to festivals and other libraries where the special event that we're attending might have different needs. And we might do 15-minute shows. We might do a half-hour show. We might do 45-minute shows, whatever the need of that particular organization is.
So you're adapting what you have depending on your audience and the needs.
Exactly.
How many actors do you employ doing this?
We have a company of 12 professional actors. They are very busy over the summertime.
I was going to say that's a lot for 12 actors to do.
Four actors can be found at the zoo every day, and they divide the work of doing those main stage performances, going to the exhibits, and it really, you know, they take a ton of the work that it takes to make a professional theater company run. You know, they're the ones that are sewing costumes when they get broken. They're the ones that are fixing the sets and putting the sets up and tearing them down. So they're a very dedicated team.
And they have to learn all the parts, right?
They do. They work in a traditional repertory format, which is, you know, pretty rare these days. So what we do is every actor knows numerous roles in lots of different shows. You know, every day at the zoo, we do four different shows. So if you come to the zoo a couple times, you could see a different show every single time. Well, that means the actors need to learn roles in all those different shows. Sometimes they know numerous roles in numerous shows, and it's something new every day.
And how long does the season last for the actors? Is it just the summer, or is this a year-round contract?
They are employees of the education department, so they are with us all year round. Okay. Now, the summertime is definitely a very busy time for us because from Memorial Day weekend through Labor Day weekend, we're at the zoo 7 days a week, and we go into the community. When we get past Labor Day, we start focusing just on the community. We actually have two touring vans that go out every day, so we can go to numerous schools or libraries or community centers on any given day.
How does theater help the educational mission of the Zoological Society in ways that other ways of reaching an audience might not?
In addition to the classroom-based programs that we offer and the keeper talks and the interpretive carts, theater's just a wonderful interpretive tool, particularly to reach people emotionally, to tell the stories of animals that can't speak for themselves.
I understand, you know, kids love that kind of thing, that kind of interaction. Do adults react to the actors as well?
I think so. With all of our plays that we develop, we focus on the whole family. So from a curriculum level, we focus on that, you know, third to fourth grade age range, because that's kind of shoots right down the middle for our audience base. But the entertainment value of it is for everyone, including the grown-ups. I see a lot of grown-ups that come back to see more shows because they want to. It's not just because their kids like it. They really enjoy it too.
And they're learning something? Does your feedback tell you that they're getting things from it?
It does. You know, for the first 3 years, we did extensive evaluation on this program to see what were people learning, what were they not learning. And we consistently saw that both adults and children had that moment of, I never knew that. And they had that positive experience at an educational level from seeing these shows.
When you take it out into the community and away from the zoo, away from the animals that you're talking about, how effective is it? Do you have to adjust since you don't have the animal right behind you to be able to really engage the audience?
You know, it's a different kind of presentation. And it's certainly something we communicate with the venues where we go. You know, we explain this isn't a live animal presentation. This is a theatrical performance. And the beautiful thing about theater is that it can be its own feature item. The actors are so engaging and the writing is so fun and the music is entertaining. That's the focus that keeps that attention in. And we hire professional playwrights that have been doing this for years. They're really focusing on this idea of what we call museum theater. You know, theater created to highlight information about a specific topic. And they do it in a way that it's almost seamless.
As Dave said, many of the shows involve music, which is lyrical music. And we know that many of the songs incorporated in the shows are great mnemonic devices to reinforce the conservation messages of the shows. And we hear at the zoo or at outreach venues, we hear people singing those songs after the plays.
Well, what do you want your audiences to take away from these shows? What's the primary thing?
From a conservation education standpoint, I'll just share that people often think of about 11 different animal species when they think of zoos. And those are elephants, rhinos, tigers, hippos.
The big ones.
Pandas, often they are the very big, what we call charismatic vertebrates or charismatic megafauna, and the three of four great apes. Milwaukee County Zoo is very fortunate to be the home of a plan to protect the rarest of the great apes, the bonobo. So most people think of gorillas, orangutans, chimpanzees, among those other large animals. If we take all those animals together, and there are about 1,070,000 of those animals in the wild presently. Half of those are about elephants. So if we take them out, those 10 other very charismatic animals, their population equals about the population of Milwaukee. So there are not many of them in the wild, and that is one thing that we like to hit home, that these animals are rare. They are, in some cases, endangered, and we, through these shows, we want to portray that message.
For me, I think a lot about the audience. You know, as a theater director, I'm always thinking about how is the audience perceiving this? And when the audiences walk away, I want them to feel empowered. I want them to know that they can make a difference. All of our shows include a message that is specific to whatever featured animal we're talking about, whether it's orangutans or polar bears or salamanders that are right here in Wisconsin. We give the children, the audience, at least one thing that they can go home and do. My hope is that they'll remember that one thing when they get home. But maybe more importantly, I want them to feel empowered. I want them to feel like they can be the one that can go forward and make a difference.
Do you have a favorite story about a particular animal that you like to tell?
Well, I'll tell you what. Most of our shows are not real-life stories. They're very fictional in the sense that the science is real. But I'll give an example. One of my favorite shows that we're doing right now is called The Legend of Hibernacula. And it's similar to Dracula, but it's all about Wisconsin bats. So the playwright did this fun thing where she took bats where they're very misrepresented. People think of them as scary. They've, you know, in those Dracula stories or horror stories, they think of them that way when, in fact, they're so important to us humans. They do so much for us. So she took the story of Dracula and was able to put these different types of bats in it that sing songs and have conflict and, again, all those elements of theater. But you walk away from it having much more respect for bats. So we use that fiction element to wrap in those young audiences.
How much do you work with school districts like Milwaukee Public Schools or other charter or other schools? Are you really kind of tied right in with that?
We are. Again, yeah. You know, thanks to Kohl's and the grant that they've provided us, we can offer this program free of charge. It means we've been very popular, of course. We go within a one-hour radius of the Zoom. So we've worked with Milwaukee Public Schools. We've worked with private schools. And we go out into the surrounding area. And so we, as I've mentioned before, travel a lot.
Well, it's a terrific program, and I want to thank both of you so much for coming in and talking about it just a little bit. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Bonnie.
James Mills is Director of Conservation Education for the Zoological Society of Milwaukee. David McClellan is Theater Coordinator. They spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North. Kohl's Wild Theater performances continue at the Milwaukee County Zoo through September 1st with four different performances each day. Another break now, and then we'll catch Wheel Fever the old school way. Very old school, in fact. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. If you're like the Lake Effect crew, you might be taking this month's Tour de France as an inspiration to take to your bicycles. It is unlikely, though, that you'd be riding an old-fashioned high wheel or early tricycle down the streets of Wisconsin, unless, of course, you're on the streets of Old World, Wisconsin, in Eagle. The Living History Museum has opened a new interactive experience it hopes will help participants catch wheel fever. Old World Director Dan Fries says participants will get to ride an old-style tricycle and pose atop a replica high wheel while learning about the bicycling boom of the late 19th century. Fries and interpreter lead Ryan Schwartz gave Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce a preview of the experience, and Fries explains how the museum came up with this participatory feature.
We started thinking about bicycling because we knew that bicycling was popular in Wisconsin back in the 19th century as well as today. So we thought it would be an interesting topic to explore as part of a new experience. And as we started to look into the history, we learned that a new book was about to be released by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press entitled Wheel Fever. And we began working with one of the authors, Nick Hoffman, to help us kind of think through what we might be able to do here at Old World that would introduce our guests to the bicycle fever that was sweeping Wisconsin back in the 1890s.
Tell us a little bit about that bicycle craze toward the end of the 19th century.
Bicycling had been around in Wisconsin for really just a very short period of time, but in the 1890s, a couple of things happened. First of all, the high-wheel bicycles. When people envision old-fashioned bicycles, they usually think of the high-wheel bicycles, and we have a couple of those as part of the experience that people can sit on and pedal, but they're stationary, so they can't go anywhere and they can't fall and hurt themselves. But right about that time in the 1890s, there started to be some advancements in the technology associated with cycling, and the new safety bicycles were coming out that were safer to ride, hence the name, and also more comfortable because they used air-filled pneumatic tires as opposed to the hard rubber tires. So it was really about comfort and safety that really made it much more accessible and more friendly to folks as far as getting involved in cycling.
Well, why don't we head into the experience?
Sure. So one of the first things as folks walk into the site, we knew from the very beginning that the real draw here was going to be the bicycle riding activity. So inside the shed, we have a variety of stations that we've set up to occupy people and engage them in exploring bicycling history while they're waiting their turn to ride on a bicycle. And as you enter the shed, one of the things that we've done is, again, we're trying to keep everything within the context of the 1890s. So instead of having a modern sign out here saying, you are now entering Catch Wheel Fever, we've disguised the orientation to the experience as a 19th century looking broadside. So it gives you all the information that you need to know as far as the fact that it's the Badger Wheelman Cycling Club, which incidentally was a real cycling club in Milwaukee in the late 19th century. And they're meeting here today. They've essentially taken over this shed as their meeting location. And while you're in here, you know, interacting with them, you can have your portrait taken with you and your bicycle. We mentioned that all ages are welcome because from the very beginning we wanted this to be an experience that was as much for adults as well as kids. And again, just trying to encourage people to come in and to explore this wheel fever.
This was a craze that swept the country. What did it look like here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think Wisconsin, to some extent, mirrored what was going on in the rest of the country. I think the thing that made a big difference here in Wisconsin was very quickly the bicycling movement equated into improvements in the road system. And one of the reasons people come to Wisconsin today to ride bicycles is because, you know, the great roads out in the rural countryside, and it was very similar back in the 19th century. The other thing is because we had already established a good manufacturing basis in particularly southeastern Wisconsin, as soon as the bicycling craze hit, all of a sudden you had factories in Milwaukee and Kenosha and other places beginning to manufacture bicycles and bicycle parts. And so all the stuff that you needed for cycling was very readily available.
Was it different out in the frontier, in some of the less established places like what Old World Wisconsin represents?
Yeah, bicycling was really more of an urban activity. And even when it did take place out in rural areas, it was, for example, a club like the Badger Wheelman coming out from Milwaukee to ride on the country roads. It wasn't a local bicycle club located in Eagle, Wisconsin. So it was still very, very urban-oriented in terms of who was riding bicycles. Now, as you got into the 20th century, that changed, and it didn't take very long before people all over Wisconsin, both urban and rural, were riding on bicycles.
Well, so Ryan, can you give us an introduction here into the Badger Wheelman Cycling Club's headquarters here?
Yeah, please, come on in. Of course, as you come in, if you listen closely, you can hear some examples of mid to late 1890s cycling music. because, of course, as Dan mentioned, that when these clubs were going out into the countryside, they would go in large groups together, and it was considered a very social affair. And so as they ride along, they're riding along in a big group, and they would sing, of course, as they went along, something as entertainment as well as looking at the sights all around. And so I think that's the first thing that people will notice when they come in, is that when they step through the door, just as you guys did, you will start to recognize that you are not, you're kind of stepping away from our current modern time period and back into what it would have been like in the 1890s, because you're getting not only the sights of one of these club halls, but as well as the sounds.
And Ryan, I see that there's this great sign over here, talk like a wheelman. Was there a specific language that was
used?
Yeah,
there was a definite lingo that they would have had back in this time period. For instance, we always warn guests not to take a header, because taking a header means they're going to flip over the handlebars and get hurt, which thankfully there's no real risk of that because we're riding tricycles here, as opposed to the high wheel bicycles that they'll see in a moment.
And yes, I see one of these high-wheeled bicycles behind us. I mean, this is, you know, kind of when I think of old-timey bicycles, this is what I'm thinking of. Is that maybe a mistake that that's kind of immediately where my mind goes?
I don't think so, because the high-wheel bicycle was the first sort of bicycle that really started to take hold in the United States. Before that, they had something called a velocipede, which was also known as a bone shaker. That was one of their terminologies, is that a bone shaker was a very rough vehicle that didn't have a very smooth ride. The first time you could really start getting a smooth ride on a bicycle was with these high wheels. And so high wheels were very expensive, though, so that's why, again, it's an urban sort of a thing. So only people in the city could usually afford them. It wasn't until you started seeing the safety bicycles that it became generally affordable for a lot of people. So you started seeing these in the 1880s and early 1890s.
Looking at this high wheel bicycle, it looks so strange to us today, but really the mechanics seem very similar. Is that kind of one of the themes you're going for, is that there really is a connection today to the activities of yore?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, and one of the things that we want people to notice is the technology associated with the bicycles. And with the high wheel bicycle, I mean, the rider sitting directly above the pedals, the one thing that you'll notice is there's no chain, there's no opportunity to actually move the gearing back underneath where the rider sits. And that changed in the 1890s with the chain drive that was used on the newer, what they called safety bicycles. And we have an example of a safety bicycle here in the shed. And this is actually a bicycle that was manufactured in Kenosha. So it's a locally made bicycle made in 1899 by the Sterling Company. But as you can see, that one of the things that changed from the high wheel to the safety bicycle is the fact that the rider can now, with the chain drive, move back farther on the bicycle and kind of be centered a little bit more over the two wheels. So it's a much more stable, safer, and hence the name, ride than what you'd get on the high wheel.
Was the experience of bicycling different between men and women, especially, you know, as that technology changed?
Oh, certainly, certainly. Of course, if you're familiar at all with the look of a high-wheel bicycle, you know it's very difficult for a lady who has to wear these long, flowing dresses in order to ride with proper dignity. It's very difficult to imagine a woman in proper dress actually getting on and riding one of these things. But when the safety bicycle started to appear, which doesn't look too much different than what many people ride today, it became much more possible. And you also saw the advent of the tricycle, which, again, we have available for guests to ride here. That would have been more of a vehicle that women would ride. And you also started to see this as a part of a social revolution among women as well. Frances Willard, who lived for a while in the Janesville area, she's a very vocal advocate of the women's rights movement. And she wrote a whole book about how she enjoyed riding bicycles because she believed it was part of a woman's liberation movement. And so bicycles took a very key role in women's rights in this time period.
Well, why don't you show us this tricycle you have over here? It looks like it's a double tricycle.
Yeah, this is essentially made for children. It's a two-seater. As you can see in the back, you have the position where maybe an older child would be able to sit and be able to pedal. And then up front, you have a much smaller seat for a much smaller child. And this is an actual original artifact that we have also started to fix up and make it look like it would have back in the olden days. We've reupholstered it and added a new rubber tire onto the front. But this is something that we recovered and saved out of Pennsylvania, and we brought here because we thought it would show an interesting way that children would have been able to ride these sort of vehicles. eBay was really helpful because, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, that's how we happened to get a hold of this one. We found an ad for it.
And the Sterling
yeah. Also were found via eBay. And then we're working with South Shore Bicycle, I believe, to restore the safety bike.
Well, what's this display over here? It looks like a bicycle repair shop, an early bicycle repair shop.
Yeah, that's exactly the idea. We actually based this off of an image that we found that came out of Oshkosh. And it shows a very typical bicycle repair shop. You have a lot of the common items that you would have found in such a place. You, of course, have your shelvings for all of your accoutrement, if you prefer. It has your oil cans and all of your tools. You also have a vise where you'd be working on things like putting the pedals together that you'd use on one of these bicycles. You have a pneumatic pump, which again is a new innovation in the 1890s. The idea that you can have tires that will actually inflate and won't throw you off of the bicycle at the slightest rock in the road. In fact, most of your listeners will be familiar with Michelin tires. Came out of France. They actually got their start in pneumatic tires, making tires for bicycles, and then later, of course, transitioned into automobile tires.
One of the other things that we're doing with the workbench area is really bringing into a history story the idea of science and technology, because oftentimes history museums kind of ignore the fact that there was science and technology associated with the past. And this allows us to bring in some hands-on activities that our guests may have seen before, but maybe in a more traditional science museum environment, but we can place them into the historical context of 1890s Wisconsin and weave it into the historical story about cycling.
But of course, the highlight of this experience is getting to go and ride the bicycles. So why don't we head on out?
Sure. Are you ready to ride one?
I'm a little nervous, actually.
Why don't we have Ryan demonstrate how to get on and off one of these, and then we'll give you an opportunity to take a spin yourself.
Sounds great.
Okay, so the best way to do this is once you have the tricycle in front of you, there's going to be a bar that you're going to have to step over, and that will place you directly behind the handlebars. So once you're in this position, you can put two hands on the handlebars and put a foot back on one of the pedals.
These are wooden block pedals, it looks like.
Yes, these are wooden block pedals, nothing metal, nothing to actually hold your feet in place, so this is definitely not made for racing. So what you can do is you can put your foot back on that block pedal and you're just going to push yourself up onto the seat. Because if you're sitting on top of it, if you're at the right size for it, your feet should be hanging about 2 or 3 inches off the ground. Now, these have a very basic drive chain, so it makes the ride a little bit easier for you. But then once you're up, all you do is you push off, and away you go.
All right, I'm up, and now
I'm... takes a little bit of a push.
A little bit of a push. Oh, my goodness. Ah!
Dan Fries is director of Old World Wisconsin in Eagle, and Ryan Schwartz is interpreter lead for the Living History Museum's new interactive experience, Catch Wheel Fever. Now open to the public, they spoke with Stephanie Lecce, who is currently still riding that tricycle, and she was assisted by interns Audrey Nowakowski and Brooke Dowden. Our feature first aired last month. This Saturday, Old World Wisconsin will also be hosting a special event featuring the Wheelmen, a group of antique bicycling enthusiasts. Visitors can sign up to take a 10-mile ride along these high-wheel bikes, watch a mock high-wheel bicycle race, or watch other demonstrations. One last break, and then a preview of an in-studio performance by singer-songwriter Slade Cleaves ahead of a concert tonight in Fort Atkinson. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Singer-songwriter Slade Cleaves grew up in Maine and now lives in Austin, but he sings convincingly of the plight of the working man just about everywhere. Cleaves will perform tonight at Cafe Carp in Fort Atkinson. He stopped by the Lake Effect studio yesterday along with fellow guitar player Scrappy Judd Newcomb. He played a few songs in Studio C1, including this one called Rust Belt Fields.
This is my town. Out in the Rustville fields, we were buying out Buicks and Oldsmobiles. There was always a job, and the money was there. Some say we got a little lazy, nobody seemed to care. But they figured it out and sent the elbow grease down to Mexico and off to the Chinese. And I learned a little something about how things are. No one remembers your name just for working hard. Into the ground till your factory's cold, and they tear it all down, and the parts get sold. Come the bankers now, picking over the bones. I got three more neighbors now, about to lose their home. As they figured it out and sent the elbow grease down to Mexico and off to the Chinese. And I learned a little something about how things are. No one gets a bonus for bloody knuckles and scars.
Singer-songwriter Slade Cleaves and Rust Belt Fields. His latest CD is called Still Fighting the War, and he'll play a concert tonight at the Cafe Carp in Fort Atkinson. We'll hear the full interview with him in the days to come. That's Thursday's edition of Like Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Like Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.
There's a casino boat. It's up around Boone. Think I'll buy me a bottle in a motel room. Put all I have left on a little black square. Risk it all like the big boys, like I don't even care. Drive you into the ground till your engine's cold.